Blog Talk Radio.
Flashback. I am Sinbad, and of course, I am joined by Katrare. How are you doing, Katrare?
I'm doing fine.
Good, good. All right, so we're going to have a special edition of the show tonight, I believe. Scotty Riggs is going to be on the line tonight, so that should be pretty fun.
Yeah.
I'm pretty stoked about that. We've covered a lot of WCW, as you know, on the show. We've been working on 1990 lately. But, you know, we covered 1992 through, what, 98 so far? Yeah, it's
a little bit of 98.
Yeah, a little bit of 98. So we're working on that. And I don't know. It's going to be a good time, I think. So
yeah.
What were you up to this week while we're waiting?
Oh, not too much. Just the same old stuff. Nothing sticks out.
Nothing sticks out.
No.
Next weekend is a big, big weekend for old Sinbad. I am going to, on Friday, I'm going to be going to Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, a live podcast taping somewhere in Illinois. I don't even know where it's at exactly. So that should be fun. And then on Sunday, obviously, is WrestleMania.
So oh, like they're going to be there?
Yeah, they're going to be there live, yes.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, that should be fun. That's one of my podcasts that I listen to. Actually, I discovered it probably, like a buddy of mine told me about it, I don't know, a month or two ago. And I started listening to them. There's like 70 episodes. And obviously, I drive around all the time, so I listen to them, a few of them every day. So I'm almost caught up. So I'm hoping by Friday, I'm completely caught up with all the podcasts. Then I go to the new one, so that should be a pretty good time.
That's cool.
Also, I wanted to plug real fast. This is my pandering section of the show. I want you guys to vote for me on Bordermania. Go to the MPI section. Vote for old Sinbad because it doesn't look like I'm going to win. And I haven't won anything in a long time on there, so maybe it'll work out for me this time.
Who is your opponent?
Rob the Nerd.
Rob the Nerd.
Actually, I met Rob the Nerd like a couple weeks ago when I was in Columbus for that Ronda Rousey versus Misha Tate fight.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it was, he's a really good guy, you know. I just don't want to lose, obviously. But he's a nice guy. I like him. He's not too bad. And later in the show, we are going to be doing a WrestleMania preview. So
yeah.
That also should be fun, I think. So
I'm very
excited
for next weekend.
Well, tomorrow on Raw, we're going to find out the last couple of members. Like, I think it's one on each team for Team Teddy and Team Johnny. So I'm thinking, well, from what I've heard today, it's Mick Foley on Team Teddy, and then we
oh,
have...
Really?
Yes, and then The Miz on Team Johnny, so... Yes.
I was thinking, well, I had heard like Alberto Del Rio and maybe Rey Mysterio was going to be on Team Teddy.
Yes. Yeah, I'd heard that too. I mean, I don't know. We'll just see. We'll just see. But and another thing that we discussed off air that like is something that we're going to get involved with after last week is. you're going to be sending me some DVDs soon. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm going to be sending you some DVDs from 1988. I got like a 20-disc set that I'm just about finished working on. I'm near the end of 1988, and I thought maybe we could cover some of those. Maybe you could watch a DVD a week. And, you know, I know you haven't seen a lot of that stuff, so it'll be good to get you caught up on that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, I think that's going to be...
And actually, I think we have our guest on, so why don't you introduce him?
All right, everybody. I'd like to introduce you to former WCW and ECW superstar Scotty Riggs. What's going on, Scotty?
Doing very good for a Sunday evening, should I say. Saw Tiger win. Saw Lodi. He was disappointed that the guy he was pulling for, not the Riggs race car driver, but the number 24 car lose today, finishing like 26th place because of a rain delay. So, you know, sports-wise, a little bit of, you know, funkadelic, a little bit crazy there. You know, good day. Can't complain. Bright, sunny. How are you cats doing tonight?
Doing just fine.
I'm doing great, actually. I'm pretty excited for the show. We've been looking forward to it all week. I've been writing down questions all day for you because it's like there's so much I want to know. There's so much I want to know, and you told me, you know, it's pretty open ended. So, you know, I'll ask the question and you answer.
The way I've been, like, I kind of come up, you know, everyone always talks about keeping it real.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of came up with a little catchphrase here of my own here of keeping it heel, because you love to hate it, you know. And the coolest thing about doing some of these interviews I've been doing lately is that I don't care who I tick off. You know, I can really get people angry at me. My friends, the guys that I wrestle with and have wrestled with and are my friends, know that I'm not going to do anything to, you know, demonize them, to hurt them, to take away their, you know, their credibility at all. But they also know that I'm going to be honest. But I'm, you know, so for me to get these interviews, you know, I don't want the fans are, if they want a promo, they watch that on Mondays and Thursdays and pay-per-views and all the other, you know, the other junk that's on. And, you know, they can catch that anytime. You know, you could have John Cena on here, and all he's going to do is rap. And, you know, if you have The Rock, he'll sit here on your radio show and raise his eyebrow at you. Or, you know, and he'll be doing that and be going, I'm raising my eyebrow at you right now, pal. You know, you can have all the character portrayals that these guys will give you. But the point in fact is right now, you know, I'm enjoying my retirement from wrestling. Make my appearances when I deem necessary, and have fun doing that. Catching up with the fans through my Twitter account, through Facebook, and reliving some of the past. Just enjoying some stuff. And you know, I can sit here and actually shoot on what happened and why things happened, and I got no consequences because, like I said, my friends, they know I'm not going to hurt them. But the people who, you know, showed their ass are going to get kicked in it.
Oh,
I don't mind, you know, taking my side of the love and letting it happen and putting it where it needs to be shot, you know, it needs to be booted. I don't want to use that phrase. That's cheesy.
And just to let you know, I don't know if you're into swearing or whatever, but we are open-ended over here. You can say whatever the hell you want, and we actually prefer it, to be honest. So let's go ahead and start.
Son of a bitch, I'm glad you said that.
All right, we can start from the beginning. You can tell us, just, you know, all of our listeners a little bit about your training and where the name Scott Studd came from.
That's pretty good. I pretty much, since about the age of 8 years old, started watching wrestling. My dad started me watching. It was Georgia Championship Wrestling, Mid-Atlantic Championship with Ric Flair, Rick Steamboat, Wrestling 1 and 2, the Anderson Brothers, Ole and Gene. You know, this is way before even Arden's time. This is, you know, back around 77, 78, you know, 79 eras, you know, when I started watching. I was also a big Dallas Cowboys fan, and I've been a Cowboys fan so pretty much. I was born and raised, in a sense, watching the NWA, which was Georgia Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, and the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, that's, you know, it was Southern football, Southern wrestling. And every now and then I got a chance to catch WWWF, three W's, F, Championship Wrestling, when we would get USA Network would run Madison Square Garden television once a month, and they would show a event from Madison Square Garden. You know, you got to see their guys. But I never really kept up with those cats. Bruno Sammartino, Boosie, Star Graham, all good things. But I played football, basketball, baseball, all those things growing up. Went to West Georgia College, Division II school, played linebacker there. Kept, you know, getting bigger in size, putting some weight on, hit a couple growth spurts, and basically went to a town right outside of Carrollton, Georgia, where West Georgia is, to a town called Bowden, Georgia, where there's a little redneck, I wouldn't even call it indie. This was a completely redneck organization. Even though they had a building, it was an old Napa auto parts store, basically, where they could keep, you know, they kept the ring up, they kept the building set up for every week for their weekly shows, and they trained twice a week. And a man named Ted Nightmare Allen, my Wikipedia says Ted Arcini, which is, I don't even know, I've never even met Ted Arcini. Don't even know, you know, I know who he is. But for him to train people to wrestle, he's a power lifter, and he was never, ever a wrestler. He was what, you know, he was what McMahon had a hard on for, with all these guys' big muscles. Kind of makes you wonder about McMahon a little bit. You know, one of the funniest things Brian Armstrong, Road Dogg, said, me and Bagwell, man, I think it was either the first episode or might have been the second episode of Are You Serious? With the American Males, the black and white video. You know, with us looking at our GQ or, you know, Abercrombie and Fitch, whatever you want to call it, type thing. People, Calvin Klein video, you know, they thought that was, you know, kind of goofy then. But 1995, that was cool.
Oh,
so,
of course.
But, you know, so the thing was, you know, Road Dogg, the funny thing, he made a comment, he goes, gee, I wonder why McMahon has that in his own personal files, you know, for us to be making fun of. Like, you know, so you kind of wonder about that, but that's probably a whole other topic, but Ted Allen was the guy who trained Arn Anderson, Tracy Smothers, Ray Traylor, who was a big boss man, Randy Anderson, the referee, Ranger Ross. He's had a tremendous impact. Ted really stayed on the he was a really, really big. He's like 5'10", about 225 pounds. But in his time, he was a tremendous wrestler, part of a tag team, the Masked Nightmares 1 and 2. Danny Davis, who was the other nightmare with him. They actually had tremendous influence, Ted Allen did, on wrestling as you see it today, because Arn Anderson is still training guys. Ranger Ross is still helping train guys. Tracy Smothers has been influencing, you know, everyone from WCW, WWF to ECW, I mean, all over the place. And so Ted, you know, basically trained me old school style. He taught me how to fall and taught me how to hit the ropes and stuff like that so I wouldn't kill myself, basically. You know, he might look to kill me sometimes, but basically, you know, taught me how to do moves and stuff like that. And I trained for about 6 weeks with Ted, had my first match. And then Ted started introducing me to some independent promoters. And I would work wrestle Ted on the shows, and that's how he trained me in front of a live crowd. And I could always tell when he actually got mad at me, he would hit me so hard with his chops in the chest. And all I would go was, sorry, Ted. And as he whack would knock the crap out of me, and then he'd just go, listen to me, kid, you know. But the thing was, and then we'd travel, you know, it was the next town, and we'd travel home, and he would give me like an up, you know, he would give me a report card. You know, you say you did this good, you did this shitty, you did this great, you did this terrible. You know, you need to work on this a little bit more to get it better. One of the guys that I give major credit to, a guy that probably you might know the name, Billy Jack Haynes, came out of Portland.
Yeah.
Who was real big. He was real big in WWF for a while. He was Black Blood and WCW for a bit. And in 95, when I was in USWA in Memphis, Billy used to watch. We had Jerry Lawler ribbed at big time because we told him that Billy Jack was my dad because we favored each other. Dark hair, you know, the the kind of mullet cut. I just didn't grow the beard that Billy Jack had. But, and we actually had Jerry Lawler believing that for probably a good, 6 weeks before we finally smartened him up and said, man, we've had you looking like an idiot for a while. He, of course, got mad at us, but, that's Jerry Lawler. He's a goofball. But the whole funny thing about it was, these guys that I met on the way and Ted taught me the basics of how to be a wrestler. And that's why I enjoyed wrestling. Not sports entertainment, not a show with the Muppets, as your special guest host. If I had to do a scene with the Muppets, I would have quit right then and there if I had to do something with Beaker. And these guys nowadays, they're not wrestlers. They're called superstars. They're called, sports entertainers. Yeah, there's an entertaining part to it, and there's a sport part to it, but I would rather be known as a wrestler than a superstar. All of them want to be on camera. All of them want to be, Twitter, whatever they call it, trending worldwide. That's all they're interested in. They're not worried about their matches. The greatest thing about ECW was the guys took huge ego in their matches. So that's what Ted taught me. He goes, man, take pride in your matches. Suspend the disbelief for these fans. Whether you're wrestling in front of 5, 10 fans, 1,000 fans, 40,000 fans, you want that guy up in that top row that's in the nosebleed seats to believe that you're hitting somebody or you're getting hit or what you're doing to hurt. And most of the time it did, I'll be honest with you, because that's where you learn. And then you learn how to, as Bret Hart would say, not to injure yourself or anybody else, but make it look as credible as possible. You kick somebody live round in the face and you don't leave a scuff mark or you don't leave a bruise, but you're still making contact. You just learned how to take care of each other because, that's how you make your living. So you don't purposely go out there to hurt somebody. Kind of like the New Orleans Saints, with their bounty thing. I think that was one of the most classic things in the world. A team named the Saints had a bounty on the injured players. So especially a team that everybody had sympathy for. They were the Ricky Steamboats of football after Katrina. Everyone, the Ricky Morton, a babyface that somebody had sympathy for that cried when he got beaten up, everything else, but. Then when they make the big comeback, you're like, people come out the seats and go crazy.
Yeah.
So, those are the things that Ted trained me and taught me well with and made me think psychologically wise. Jake the Snake Roberts helped me a lot in my psychology. I traveled with him for about a good five to six months in 94. And he was one of the guys who basically got Jerry Lawler to take a look at me and bring me into USWA. Because Arn Anderson, again, another Ted Allen trainee, told me, he goes, dude, you're here in WCW, you're working TVs, you're working house shows, but you're not really going anywhere because, you don't have anybody really pulling for you yet. He goes, and Arn Anderson told me this, straight in my face, center stage. He goes, you need to get out of here. Bischoff is gaining control. Dusty Rhodes is gaining a little bit of control but losing some of it. He goes, you need to get out of here before these guys just abuse you because you got a great look, you got a great ability. I know Ted trained you. You got a great psychology. He goes, you need to leave here. And that was like in November of 94. And I had my first match February 6th of 92. So I'd only been wrestling for about a year and a half, and I had this conversation with Arn. And then I did a match right around Thanksgiving in Warner Robins, Georgia, and Jerry Lawler was there. Jake Steck was there, and Jake introduced me to Lawler. Lawler watched my match, said, hey, I would like to come to USWA, gain some experience and some exposure. I said, cool. He goes, you don't make but $40 a day, but you wrestle 5-6 nights a week. You gain experience, you gain exposure, but you pay your dues. And I said, love it. Because at the time, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to wrestle. I really did. That was my passion. And to learn that way, because you wrestled four nights a week in Memphis, or Saturday was Nashville after Memphis TV. So you had to come up with two different ways of wrestling your matches that day. Monday was Memphis, so you had to come up, you know, create new ways of starting, ending, finishing, you know, matches. And Louisville on Tuesdays, same thing. Wednesday, Evansville, Indiana, same thing. I mean, every night you had to come up with a new way to start things because fans follow that stuff religiously, especially in the territory days. They, I mean, they followed it, you know, and they believed in the violence of the sport. That's what they loved it. And that's what Ted taught me. He goes, the more, even as a good guy, the more violent you are, the more violence you take, the more credible you're going to be. And so, I mean, I just basically took that to heart.
You worked in Smoky Mountain Wrestling and USWA. Those were really the last two territorial areas.
Very much so. I mean, I spent maybe a few weeks in Smoky Mountain with Jake. Jake brought me in doing, basically Jake was using me for a ride in one sense. Cheryl wouldn't let him drive the car. That was his wife at the time. But, of course, remember, I'm sure you probably know them from the Rick Rude incident that they made a big storyline out of. But long story short, Jake had taken me and introduced me to Jim Cornette. Said he got this young kid here, he could do some pretty good things. And Jake told Cornette that I knew how to do that 450 splash that Tuco Scorpio could do. And I couldn't do that for nothing. I was like, Jake, what the hell are you trying to get me into? He goes, just work with me, kid. I'm going to get you a job here. I was like, okay, you know, and I knew New Jack from starting off also in North Georgia Wrestling, a little independent group that had a TV show when he was part of the Gangsters with Mustafa. And so I knew some of the guys, and I knew Tommy Rich, and I knew Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson who were in there and those guys. So they kind of brought me in. I met Chris Candido, and he was with Sonny, and me and Candido had a match on TV that we only had like maybe 5-6 minutes with intros and everything. And so basically we only had 3 to 4 minutes to put some action into, you know, a TV match and really, really be good. And we and Chris, I mean, I give him a lot of the credit for it because I was still very young. Chris made me look like $1 million. Steve Austin is another guy. I had an 8-minute match with him on WCW Saturday Night that Sam Houston was supposed to be there. Sam Houston didn't make the show. Jody Hamilton said, hey, put this young guy, Scott Studd, and you asked him about the stud name. I got that from the independent promoter at the time. Wow, again, from the redneck promoter, basically, at the time, because I was a young, good-looking kid, college athlete, you know, worked out, whole nine yards. You know, just a good-looking kid. He goes, you know, you're a stud, and you know, and that's what we're gonna call you, Scott Stud. It's my first name is Scott, and I want to keep something simple. You know, I don't want to be named Billy and have to answer to Scott all the time. You know what I mean? So, I spent a couple weeks in Smoky Mountain, and Jake got into a little bit of his shenanigans there, and so they kind of got rid of him. And then when they got rid of him, I kind of moved on from Smoky Mountains, kept on working some other independents with Greg Price, who does the NWA Legends reunion stuff now. But Greg was running South Atlantic Pro at the time, and I had actually been working some for him already, and that's where me and Rob Van Dam met in 93 and became really good friends. And, you know, I was just very blessed, you know, in the start of my career that I was able to be a part of Smoky Mountain and know guys that would take time to, you know, they knew who trained me. They knew Ted Allen trained me. So these guys took time to help me, to watch me, to say, hey, if you work on this, you're going to get better with this. Arn Anderson, I give him major credit, who told me to get out of WCW. You know, you're not under contract. You're under a nightly deal. You're making decent money, and sure, you're on TV and everything, but if you really want to make it in this business, you need to get out of here. And I left there, and the funny thing was, Jerry Lawler goes, I'm going to call you around the first of the year and give you a starting date. I said, okay, January 1st, I get a phone call. No lie, about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Randy Hales, who was the booker at the time, calls me up and says, yeah, I'm supposed to get you in here. Your starting date is the 14th of January, Memphis TV. You need to be at Channel 5 at 7:30 in the morning. We go live at 9:30, and we're off at 11. I'm like, okay. And then he goes, and then your next, you know, and then you're in Nashville that night, your next 2 weeks, you're booked, boom, boom, boom. He goes, I can get you on any Thursday, Friday independent shows that we also book our guys with, but I have you booked for the next 2 weeks on this, then we'll go from there. And I ended up spending 8 months in Memphis. So, you know,
speaking of Memphis,
that,
just real fast.
That part there just Arn Anderson told me to get out of there and go do that. I mean, I was blessed. Very, very lucky.
Of course.
Very, very, you know, take advantage of every opportunity that was given to me.
All right. Speaking of Memphis, Jerry Lawler's the mainstay there. A lot of people either love him or hate him. What was your relationship with him? What was that?
I said he's an ass.
Is that right?
Yes. He was to me. Long story short, in the middle of a dressing room, he had taken me to WWF at the time and was going to show me off, give me a couple dark matches and let me work some guys and show what I could do. And at the time, even a young Chris Benoit was there, and Chris had worked like Owen Hart in 3 straight dark matches one night, and I was just watching that. I'd worked a guy named Gorgeous George, who's Robbie Eagle, in the dark match. And I still remember the building was in Pittsburgh, I think. I'm trying to run it through my mind here. But it was where they filmed the movie Slapshot with Paul Newman. And it was an old building, and it was a hockey arena. But they had it set up for the tapings and stuff like that, and I wrestled a dark match there. They were kind of impressed with what I did. So they brought me back then. A couple weeks later, Waller says, I want to bring you in here and maybe use you. We're going to use you as Lex Luger's flag bearer, and he's going to do a match with Yokozuna, and you're going to take a shot from Fuji, and Lex is going to come out, make the save for you. Then he's going to get, you know, beat by, you know, count out to the to Yokozuna so Yokozuna can move forward. And we're going to make you. Since you're from Atlanta also, and you worked at Electric Sting's gym, we're going to make you like a protege, an All-American kid, to be with the All-American Lex Luger. You know, we're going to make you a protege of his. So we go in there, we do this. But the whole time, about a month earlier, I get a call from Kevin Sullivan and Janie Engel about coming to WCW to be Bagwell's partner because the Patriot had just left. So here I am in USWA, and I'm getting, you know, an opportunity possibly with WWF. And I'm getting phone calls in Louisville, Kentucky at the Holiday Inn we stayed at. I don't know how they got my number there or how they got a hold of me. But my phone rings my room, and it's Janie Engel, who's the head secretary. And she says, got Kevin Sullivan wants to talk to you. Here's Kevin. Boom. Puts me on the phone with Kevin Sullivan. Hey, Ken, I hear you're doing great over there in USWA. And, you know, he says, you know, he's got that Boston accent and everything. And he's just going into, you know, this, that, and the other. You know, Patriot just left. We got Bagwell and Alex Wright doing this thing. And they suck. And there's no, you know, we want to put you and Bagwell together. We think maybe you might have a good chemistry. You got a great look. And you know, we see, like, the fantastics out of you guys. We see, like, Rock and Roll Express, a younger version of that. We see this really good, strong babyface tag team. You know, the 80s, you know, the late 80s type of babyface mentality. And so here I go, and this is where Jerry Lawler's an ass. I go up to Lawler. Lawler's want me to go do some more TVs, and I told Kevin about that. And Kevin goes, don't you go on any of their TVs. And even Terry Taylor, who came in to look me out, scout me a little bit, said, don't do any more of their TVs if you want this chance with Bagwell. And so in front of the entire locker room, probably about 20-some guys, you know, I pulled Jerry aside and said, you know, Jerry, you know, want, you know, start shaming off you guys. Want you guys to come to TV this week, da 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 da. You know, I'll probably work in this one. I don't know yet, but this, and then I walked up to him and said, Jerry, I can't go. WCW is interested in me. And Lawler goes, hey, everybody, listen to this. Listen to Scott Steady. I was still by Scott Steady. He goes, listen to this kid. WCW is interested in him. And this is in front of the entire locker room. I mean, guys of Tommy Rich, Doug Gilbert, which, you know, was just guys that were just, you know, his son, Brian Lawler. I mean, all these guys that were there.
They're your peers. They're your peers.
Exactly. I mean, and he's sitting there busting my chops going, WCW is interested in him. He goes, you can go do TV. And as soon as he said this, I knew he was going to set me up to just be beaten on their TVs. He goes, you can go do their TVs, lose every match on their show, and still be hired by WCW if you think that you're going, you know. And he's standing with this goofball look on his face, like, you're going to WCW. Wow. You know, and I, you know, I'm sitting there going, well, I'm not doing it, and, you know, you can take it any way you want. I'm out of here, you know. And the very next, and Lawler is just all over me. So he takes his guys next week to do the TVs and stuff. I didn't go. That very next week, I get a call from Janie saying, okay, this coming Monday, we, you know, it's a Wednesday. We're in Evansville, Indiana. I'm wrestling Tracy Smothers that night at the house show, and I'm getting a whim, and Janie's like, we need you to come in to Atlanta this Friday to meet up with Bagwell, to get some outfits put together, do some stuff, get some, you know, some game plans put together, and then we got you in Orlando for the next 2 weeks doing our syndicated show tapings, you know, for Worldwide and Pro. And I said, oh, okay, you know, this is Wednesday. You know, Wednesday afternoon. Wednesday night, I got to tell the booker that I'm leaving that night to head back to Atlanta because I got the meetings on Friday, got to prepare my weekend, and then I'm in Orlando on Monday with WCW. So here I go do that. They go bonkers because they want a two-week, you know, like everybody else wants, you know, that two-week grace period, you know, when you're leaving. And again, this is where Lawler was an ass to me. You know, he comes back in and hears that I left, calls me up, dogs me out, says, if you want to ever come back here again, you're not welcome. You know, I'm going to be talking to Jeff Jarrett's dad, Jerry Jarrett, make sure that you're never be able to come back here because I know that you're not going to make it to WCW. And I'm just sitting there going, wow, you know, here's a guy who was Mr. Opportunity for me, is now Mr. One, you know, wants to see me fall down and fail. So he's an ass. Again, he may be a great cartoonist. I know his ex-girlfriend Stacy the Cat real well, and we still talk. And we, you know, she's a tremendous person. She used to cut my hair and let me tan at her salon for free back then, and I was the only one that she let do that. And so she kept me actually looking, and, you know, with my Mel Gibson haircut back in mid-'95, which was popular back then. You know, so she kept me in a good look and tanned and everything else. When I was in Memphis, she'd take care of me. So, you know, just, again, Lawler just was an ass. And the funny thing was, the whole issue with me being Luger's flag bearer and his protege, the very first Nitro in Memphis, or in Minneapolis, me and Bagwell wrestled Dick Slater and Buckhouse Buck in a dark match at the Mall of America. They had three matches on the show, and a special guest of Lex Luger, who had just wrestled the Sunday night before in Nova Scotia. His contract was up. He had no 90-day clause or anything else. He was done with WWF, and that very next day he was in WCW, signed a contract, and was with them. So if I would have stuck with Lawler and the idea that he had, I would have just, my career probably would have went, you know, on a much more roller coaster ride instead of going on the nice little rocket ship that it did, you know, winning the world tag team titles in the third ever Nitro out of Johnson City with Bagwell. Me and Bagwell ended up having great chemistry. We really did. It was just boom. In moments, it just seemed like we knew what each other was thinking. So, I mean, that was the coolest part about it.
Of course.
You know, I left Memphis with a bad taste in my mouth. But the funny thing was, about a month later, I get a letter with the USWA figurehead on it and everything else, and handwritten to me, and it was from Jerry Jarrett thanking me for the 8 months, apologizing for Jerry Lawler, I've seen Lawler before, and he will not speak to me even years later, you know, almost 20 years later. I mean, I bumped into him at some shows in 2003 was about the last time I saw him, maybe 2004, that I actually walked up to him and tried to say hello to him. They were at the Phillips Arena. I was in Atlanta with Dusty Rhodes and some of his guys. They were having some dark matches for WWE. I walked up to Jerry and said hello, and he looked at me and was like, "What do you want?" I said, "I don't want anything from you. I just want to say hello, but if that's where you're going to be, that's where you're going to be." So I turned around and walked off. And then, you know, he still is a grumpy old son of a gun, and or son of a bitch, but that's just the way he is. And, hey, you know, he portrays this happy-go-lucky guy, I guess, on TV, but in real life, I think he's just a grumpy little, you know, son of a gun who thought he should have been a bigger star than he was. He's a great commentator, or play-by-play, whatever you want to call him. But he's, you know, when it came down to his wrestling skills, all he had was to pull down the strap, you know, that he had on his goofy singlet that he had. And that was his thing, you know. And as soon as everybody knew that, once he did, it was like Hulk Hogan hulking up, you know. That was his thing. As soon as everybody saw that, they were like, "Oh, my gosh, he's going to come back and he's going to win." Whether he won or lost, everybody got fired up because he pulled the strap down. Because, "Oh, my gosh, he's mad now." So...
That's crazy.
To answer
That's
your
crazy.
Question again briefly, Jerry Lawler's an ass.
you were talking about Luger coming in right after you, like right after that Nitro. Did you and him ever discuss the flag bearer thing or the protege storyline?
The funny thing was, we had only had a brief meeting with Tony Garea, who was a road agent from at the time, and Blackjack Lanza, to discuss what we were doing at TNA at that time, and then even brought up the idea of the All-American thing. And Luger was with it. He was like, you know, that'd be a great thing because it would help him with the All-American thing to bring a guy up from, you know, where he was from, Atlanta, and the whole nine yards. He had met me at his gym before, but didn't, you know, we didn't know each other. And I've actually talked to Lex 2 days ago on the phone, and the funny thing was is that Nitro, we were staying at the Marriott in Minneapolis, and we went to get a bite to eat, and it was John B. Badd, Marcus, Stinger, Alex Wright, myself, and Lex. We all pretty much got the chicken primavera, which is pasta and chicken, you know, with some broccoli in it and stuff and the cream sauce. And these guys ate their whole meal in like 5 bites. They're all just, they barely spoke a word. I'm just sitting back eating, and I never ate like that. So I'm just sitting there eating nice slow, and Lex is going, "Don't tell me we got this, you know, this punk kid is going to waste our evening by eating like a slow little pan, you know." And he is just ripping me a new a-hole. And I'm sitting back going, "You got to be kidding me," you know, and I'm just... He don't even remember a few months ago when we were together. And Stinger is actually trying to take up for me, going, "Dude, I wish I could actually enjoy my meal that more." And Lex is like, "No, you don't. He's a stupid punk kid," because he knew I was a youngster. and I reminded Lex that we were laughing about, because Lex is like, "Dude, you know, he comes, you know, down from Atlanta, down towards Florida and stuff, to do speaking engagements now." And he's like, "Dude, sometime, you know, when we're around Savannah or something, you know, or Jacksonville or, you know, somewhere in that vicinity, maybe we can meet up and have some lunch, you know, and just catch up and talk and see each other," because we haven't seen each other in a couple of years. And I said, "Dude, that would be awesome." I said, and that's how I remembered. I said, "Dude, I still remember the first time we had a meal together." And Lex goes, No, I wasn't ribbing you back then. I was probably just being a jackass because I was pretty much a jerk back then. And I was really pretty well being a jerk to you. I think that's why Sting maybe stood up for you. Because you were a youngster. You were the complete rookie of the set. You hadn't even been there but a few weeks. And I was only under a 90-day trial contract anyway. That turned into a five or six-year career with him, basically. But I was actually longer than I wasn't under contract with him. But from 95 when I got my contract until 2000, so 5-6 years that I was actually under a contract with those cats. So, you know, it was just a wacky time, I guess you could say, to be a friend of Lecter's and to be the newbie, the rookie, the driver, all the things that I had to be at the time. And believe me, Lex made sure that I paid my dues. But he also made me look good in the match we had in December, not too much long ago. We had to actually tape a match. It was for the Christmas show. You know, Christmas fell on a Monday, and we couldn't have a live show that day, so we taped stuff beforehand. And we'd all travel together that day. It was Lex, Sting, Marcus, myself. And we get there, and they're like, well, you know, we're going to tape this. We're going to try to tape maybe 2-3 matches beforehand and then 2-3 matches after. Me and Lex are like, we found out we had to wrestle each other. Like, hey, okay, whatever. And all of a sudden they come rushing in going, you know, we got hats on our head, and we're, you know, not really totally prepared, and we're just getting dressed. And they're like, hey, you guys are on in like, you know, 20 minutes. You know, we're starting tapings early so we can get some matches taped that we can get out. And we're like, what? So we jumped out there, and we looked at each other and said, let's go out there with ugly hair. You know, it's our rib for each other, but, you know, normally I'm all primped, and you're pretty, you're American male and everything else. Let's go out there with hatheads. This was Lex's idea. I went, you sure? And I'm like, he's like, yeah, it'd be great. We can giggle the whole time about it. So then I went from being Lex's ragdoll to being one of Lex's closest friends. So
how's he doing?
It was definitely a fun time.
How's he doing these days?
He's actually doing tremendously better. We spoke about that because I actually had, he had that motorcycle accident years before where he still got a steel plate in his elbow. I'd actually had an accident where I fractured a bone in my arm. I had 13 screws and 2 steel plates in there, and I had 3 surgeries on it. And I had talked to Lex about that. He was like, well, dude, you've got great recovery skills. I know you're training, because I trained with Lex for a while. And he goes, you know, if you can, if anybody can overcome this, it's something you can. But unfortunately, if I straighten out my arms, my right arm goes about a good 5 inches further than my left, because my left arm, there's no cartilage in there anymore. But going back to your question, everybody thought it was a stroke that paralyzed him from the neck down, but basically from playing football, and we had both discussed this a little bit, we said from playing football and doing things that a lot of the other guys didn't do through college, you know, he played professional football for Packers and I think somebody in the USFL also, but you know, so we had basically put our bodies through a little more wear and tear than other guys had, and he just went to sleep one night, woke up the next morning, paralyzed from the neck down. And if a maid hadn't come in and checked the room, he probably would have still been laying there for who knows how long. But and it's still not a given reason why, other than wear and tear, and somehow in his sleep, there was a shutdown of his neurological system.
I remember
probably
that.
about 80%, or he's mobile now. You know, he's not jacked like he used to be. You know, because he can't work out. He really, you know, he's gained mobility. He still does his physical therapy rehab stuff, but he can drive himself around now. He can get around with some help. He's always got a guy that's with him that travels with him and stuff like that that helps him out and those things. But, you know, he's doing from a guy who was first diagnosed to never, you know, to basically be a quadriplegic when they first, you know, looked at him and everything, to where he is now, he's come a million miles. And I always say, you know, his nickname was the Total Package for the longest time. And I'm like, well, now really he is the Total Package because, you know, he's not just physical, but he's heart, mind, soul, spirit, and everything else, where, you know, he is that Total Package. And so I give him props for that. And he even admits all the mistakes he's made in his life beforehand, where his ego, you know, cost him a lot of things and got him a lot of things, but ended up in the end, you know, biting him in the ass. But, you know, but now he's more joyful now than he's ever been in his life before. So, you know, I give him mad props for that.
Now, going back to the tag team, were you surprised that you guys got the belt so early? Because it wasn't long after you started teaming, was it?
No, it was, like I said, it was the third Nitro, and they kind of went, you know, me and like I said, Kevin Sullivan put us in a match with the Blue Bloods, which was, at the time, it was Steve Regal, William Regal, whichever one you want to call him, and Bobby Eaton at the time, and they basically told Regal and Eaton, you know, to give me the once-over to really, you know, make me work my butt off in the match to see how me and Bagwell would work together. And I probably had 90% of the match in the ring. Bagwell had about 10%. Then went back and gave Kevin mad raves about my abilities, my selling, my work rate all over. And when I pinned Regal, I still remember, and you can almost hear it on the tape, I'm like, thank you, sir. You know, and just giving them respect. You know, he's putting me over. He just gave me the hardest workout in the ring basically I had, and I didn't know this, but you know, it was right after that there was Fall Brawl '95. We were working at Nasty Boys, and Sullivan and them, you know, brought us in on Saturday and said, you know, we're having this match where Dick and Buck at the pay-per-view are going to lose their titles to Harlem Heat. Nasty Boys, you guys are going to put over the American Males on the main event show. And then Males, we want you guys to shock the world, in a sense, and win the tag team titles on Monday on our Nitro, because we, you know, the Nitro needed that kind of oomph, you know, type thing. It needed that shock value down to kind of give it some credibility. And of course, Jerry Sags hated that idea. Knobs, he didn't like it, but Knobs is a good guy. He understands business. Sags is a dickhead. respect the man, but if you ever watch the match, he puts me in the corner, knows I'm the rookie. There's 22 unanswered punches and kicks that are live rounds where Bagwell is getting in the ring going, what the hell are you doing? Randy Anderson, the referee, is, what are you doing? And even Brian Knobs runs over and pulls Sags off, and Sags is just literally going, I'm not the one to put these punks over. This is in the ring, you know. This is bullshit, and he's just beating on me because he knows that I'm respectful to a point, and he caught me off guard. That's the thing, that, you know, when Scott Hall nailed him with a chair, you know, I kind of was kind of like, hey, karma's a bitch, isn't it? You know, when he got that big concussion and had a football-sized knot on the back of his head and neck and fairly much ended his career, you know, I was like, dude, at the start of mine, you know, you just waylaid into me and, you know, just because you were upset about having to lose a match. You know, and I just don't have any respect for that. But Knobsy, you know, I mean, he came over and, you know, and was like, you okay, kid? And, you know, and is, you know, was trying to check on me too. Everybody except for Sags was worried about me. Mm-hmm. And so that very next night, they were even talking about it. Bischoff was talking about how bad of an ass kicking I took from the Nasty Boys in that match, and was bumping really good. And I took that spin kick from Booker Tito, okay, it killed me. But it was the easiest thing in the world. When Stevie shot you off and you took that kick, it's like that leg lariat, whatever you want to call it, that spin kick that Booker did. If you took it running, you were fine. If you took it off a spinneroonie, he dislocated my jaw twice. Let's just say that much. Because of the contact. Because it's a tough contact move, but if you have the time, you know, if you can get your timing down, boom. And when I hit it, if you watch everyone's reaction, I've watched it. Bagwell winces. Sherry and even Nick Patrick are like, oh, my God. You know, they even flinch because it looks so good. And Stevie just raises his hands up going, oh, my God. Everyone's reaction is like, that. I just made that move, you know, for him. And that was just one of the coolest things in the world. When you can do something like that and then give a guy who ends up for the next 10-plus years of his career using that move and turning into the spinneroonie and everything else that everyone basically got into, you can just sit back and go, wow, you know, I had a part in that. And that came off of that one match. But then when we won the tag team titles, it was like, great. You know, it was the huge boost that, you know, I just left Memphis where I put 70,000 miles on my own vehicle, made less than $6,000, had Jerry Lawler telling me I was worthless, would never ever be able to come back there for a job because he knew I was going to be a failure in WCW, and here I am, a world tag team champ. And Arn Anderson had told me to get out of here, you know, because if you hadn't gotten out of here, you know, you're going to be nothing. You're going to get stuck under a glass ceiling. You got to get out of here, kid. And so all I remember is a lot of those emotions kind of caught up with me at the time. And when I was in the corner of a building, it was Johnson City, it was at Freedom Hall. I was in the corner of a building sitting in a chair with the belt in my hand. I had, you know, scared, a little teary-eyed and a little just emotions. They really kick into you because it's real. You know, it's
yeah.
From whatever the fans think or not, you know, your emotions, you're still a real person. And it really gets to you, you know, when you succeed in certain things and when you fail. You know, it's the whole gamut. But Arn Anderson walks up to me and he looks at me and says, see, I told you 8-9 months ago, you need to get out of here. And look at you now, kid, you won't have to roll a tag team champs. I'm proud of you. He goes, but the thing is, me and Flair are going to beat your ass for the belts in a couple of weeks. So get ready to get rid of them. He said that jokingly, you know? And so that was his way of welcoming me into the fold in a sense. So, you know, For us to win the belts, you know, even Marcus was excited because here he was a part of an eclectic tag team that was us, that was him. It wasn't, you know, him and Too Cold Scorpio where he came out with Too Cold Scorpio's music. It wasn't him and the Patriot where he came out in the Patriot Stars and Stripes and Stars and Stripes music. It was actually a gimmick that was him and me as a unique tag team with our own music. And we win the world tag team titles. You know, we're not just a, you know, Marcus has been stuck in that tag team thing, and he got put with guys, but it was with other guys' personas that he had to play along with. You know, he had no individuality. He had no, even as a tag team, he wasn't an individual. You know, it was the other guy in the tag team that he's playing second fiddle to. So he was excited that as an American male, Bagwell and Riggs, that we had actually, you know, won the world tag team titles. And he was, and I remember we were driving back from Johnson City with Brian Pillman, and, you know, we were just sitting back just laughing and cutting up, and it was one of the best rides ever. Just because we were having a good time coming on the way back. We had a few drinks, a few beers on the way, and you know, we weren't doing anything bad, but we were just excited. We were celebrating. And it was just that joyous relief, you know, that release that you just went, wow, we just won the tag team titles live on Nitro. You know, it was just, it was tremendous, you know.
That sounds like it. Speaking of Bagwell, I had a couple of questions. Number one, what was your first impression of him? And then also, as we move on, like as you're talking, can you tell us a little bit about how you found out that the team is breaking up, like who told you and how that all came about? So if you could go ahead.
Well, long story short, me and Marcus have met on some other shows and stuff, and, you know, we're always very nice to each other. I mean, he was never a jerk or anything like that. So, we, you know, in 93, 94, when I was working just on a nightly deal with like, Eric Watts was doing the same thing, and me and Eric were traveling together some, and him and Bagwell were really good friends because they lived near each other in Woodstock, Georgia, and we just, you know, we never really had a, we had kind words. We weren't pals, you know, we weren't buddies or anything like that. We never hung out together, but we were cordial to each other. You know, we were nice. We'd chit-chat and we'd talk here and there, but nothing big, nothing major. And then when he put us together as a tag team, Marcus, you know, I guess, knew how well I was doing. He had been hearing this, and they had already talked to him about putting me and him together. And, of course, if he didn't want it, he would have tried to stick with Alex. And, you know, I think he knew that that wasn't going to get over, and they told him it wasn't going to get over. They wanted to bring me in to be his tag team, and, you know, they, you know, told him, you know, this could be something good for you. So our chemistry, like I said, it just happened. And when that, and that's a rare thing. It's like a Ric Flair, Rick Steamboat thing, or a Flair and Sting thing. You know, it was just instant chemistry when you get in the ring with a guy and you know it's money. So we got on there, did our thing, and we just knew that we were going to be together for a while. And it worked out really well. The only thing that hurt us is we should have been heels. We should have been bad guys because we were getting that John Cena reaction, in a sense, where we'd walk out and the guys would boo the crap out of us. But the girls would cheer, you know, cheer crazy, you know, because the guys hated us because they knew that we could steal their girlfriends. You know, that was basically what the scenario was. But the girls loved us because every one of them wanted to be with us, you know. So it was a crazy reaction. And that was every time we went out there. But we were the only good guys tag team they had. They had the Nasties. They had Dick and Buck. Harlem Heat, you know, they had guys that, you know, State Patrol, Men at Work, they had these other teams that could not really, maybe Nasties could have flip-flopped, but not really, not at that time, that they just did not have any good guys, and we were stuck being good guys. Even get the reaction we were getting, we even spoke to them, we were like, God, we should be bad guys. And, you know, it would be so easy. Guys, we know you hate us because you want to be like us. And we know your girls love us because they want to be with us. And girls, you know, we used to own line from Flair. You can't be first, but you could be next. So just get in line. You know, and the minute we do something like that, the guys will hate us and the girls will hate us. Because then we're all of a sudden too egotistical for our own good. And that would have been a realistic view of how people were already viewing us. So, and then slowly they were wanting to split us up, and that's when we started, you know, doing our little fumbleitises and stuff in matches. But nothing was, you know, they were just trying to show a little discord between us. That was Kevin Sullivan's idea, and that was basically after Nash and his guys came in. And Nash, who basically, when he was doing the Oz character and Vinnie Vegas and all that, was traveling with Bagwell because Bagwell was making like 140 grand a year and Kevin Nash was making like 50 grand a year. So Kevin Nash was this huge monster. He was making nothing. And Bagwell was making three times as much as he was, basically. So they were friends. They split time on the road together. So here comes Nash all of a sudden with a $1 million contract. And for the kindnesses that Bagwell showed to him and traveling together and splitting and stuff, you know, expenses on the road, said, hey, we're going to do this deal. We're going to have, you know, guys who want to jump over and join the NWO, which was probably the worst thing I think they ever did. If they would have stuck to a NWO with just like the Hogan, Nash, Hall, maybe, you know, bring Macho in, bring Kurt in, bring some of the guys that came in from WWE at the time, or WF, I can't remember what they were. I didn't really care, but those guys that were coming in, if they would have been there. Instead, they wanted defectors, and all of a sudden the defectors came in, and that just took something that was a really, really gusto of a thing and watered it down with WCW guys. Because sooner or later you knew all those WCW guys would not be a part of it anymore. You know, no matter how they did it. And then with Sting and Luger and all them joined, all of a sudden you had the Wolfpack, the Red and Black, which was the head guys of NWO. Then you had the Black and White, which was the B-Team, which were all the guys that were going to lose no matter what of the NWO. And so, again, a whole watered-down version of something that changed everything. And that actual night that Bagwell joined in, he was supposed to work with Steve Regal on that Nitro and put Regal over. So Bagwell was pissed off, and I went to Nash and said, Nash, this is what's going on tonight. Can we do this thing tonight? And Nash said, dude, I got creative control on my contract. Hell yeah, we'll do it tonight. We'll change this whole thing and bring you out here and do this whole smiles and we'll turn on Riggs. No problem. Let's do it tonight. I'm going to talk to Bischoff now. We'll get the whole program changed. And that's what they basically did. And that was the worst thing about the NWO. All those guys had creative control. Nash, Hall, Hogan, those guys, if they came in and didn't like what was going on a three-hour Nitro, 2 hours before the show was going on, they want everything rewritten, changed, because they didn't want a match, but they wanted two promos at the top of every hour, which was your highest rating times, and a run at the end of the night where they would beat somebody up in the overrun and look cool. And that's all they wanted to do. Every now and then they work a match because they, you know, they basically would say, you know, we have to have you wrestle a match tonight. And, of course, they end up working something in a big angle style match. But Bagwell did that thing, you know, and that was – and I was actually happy for Marcus because he had been a good guy, a squeaky, clean, purebred white babyface, good, you know, just made you sick almost. He was so good. I actually was thinking it was going to be so really, really good for him as an individual wrestler to do this. And so, and then I knew maybe it might, you know, burst me up a little bit because I'd be involved in a program. We knew we were working each other at the NWO sold out pay-per-view. We left right after that, and I gave him the blockbuster finish, actually, in the Cedar Rapids Hotel, in our hotel room. We were trying to tell us he wanted to come up with some type of finish off the top rope, and I knew he was trying to do a Rick Rude type thing, so I said, well, why don't you end up we'll do a thing from the top where you stand up there and someone like, can you cut a flip, catch me in the neck, and it's like the Rude Awakening, but it's a flying version of it. And Marcus was like, well, I don't know, let's try it. So he stood on the bed, and we did a flip over, and caught me in the thing, boom, and next thing you know, we did it on pay-per-view, and the Blockbuster was born. But again, here I am, I'm giving guys moves that I'm somebody going, I should have stole that myself, you know, or should have, you know, why am I giving away all the good stuff? But, you know, then we went to Japan for 3 weeks, came back, and we had a Nitro where I worked with Chris Jericho, where he came out and started hitting me with a belt, and we set up the Uncensored pay-per-view strap match. And so then he edged, and again, here, you know, I know I'm putting him over because he needs the big heel rub at the time, and it's nice sympathy for me, you know, as a good guy. So, you know, it's making sense. And, you know, I'm thinking this is going to be a nice, really good, solid push for Marcus as a singles competitor finally in his career. And it'd be a good, nice, you know, push for me as a baby face that I can actually get established as myself in a sense. And unfortunately, it didn't take Marcus but about a few months to become Vicious and Delicious. And to me, you know, it was Scott Norton. And I love Scott Norton to death. I have no but high praise for that man. He has been a true friend to me. But when they became Vicious and Delicious, I said they sound more like, you know, prison cellmates than they did like a tag team. And, of course, you know which one was Vicious and which one was Delicious. So pitcher and catcher, if you will. So that's where, you know, You know, he called himself Buff, and I said it in a magazine article, and Patty Ferry, who was the editor of the WCW, her and Colin Farrell, or Farrell, not Farrell as the actor, but he, this guy, he was an English guy, and she was American, and they were like the co-editors of WCW magazine, but I did an interview with her, and I said that, you know, Marcus Houghton, Buff, he's bloated. You know, and he actually got legitimately mad at me for saying that. I'm just like, dude, it's a thing, it's a comment. You're saying I'm fat, and you think that that's cool, but I said you're bloated and you get mad? I'm like, Marcus, you're ridiculous. And that's when he started becoming Buff a little too much. That was his split identity, I guess you could call it. And when he was Marcus, I love him like a brother. When he was Buff, he was almost about the size of an ass of a Jerry Lawler. So,
hey, Scotty, we got a caller online. You mind taking a phone call?
Yes, I mind. No.
Okay, hold on real quick.
I'm here to tell you.
Oh, hi! This is Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh, no.
Oh,
I got two questions for Scotty Riggs.
Well, number one, I know this ain't Gilbert Gottfried because your impersonation of him sucks. So,
anyways, did you like being a part of the flock? And what was the deal with the eye patch? You looked like a pirate.
Well, the flock was a very cool thing because Raven was trying to make me the Tommy Dreamer version at the
long
time. Me and Raven were actually very good friends, and he was going to almost do some of the things with the Tommy Dreamer, you know, battles that him and Dreamer had with me and him. And that's when we did the drop toe hold into the chair, where I actually did injure my eye. Long story short, it was a legit injury where I had a detached retina that basically the bright lights of TV and everything were giving me headaches, and vision was blurred. So I had to put an opaque contact lens in there and wear the eye patch to protect the eye and to protect myself from having the headaches and stuff from still able to watch matches. So I was actually legally blind in that eye and had no depth perception. And the patch, you know, the whole thing, I'm a little upset that you guys didn't find my Sugar Ray song and introduce me to that, because that movie, I was actually going to play off a bit. If you ever watched what I was doing and some of my movements in the ring where I would slide around a little bit, I was actually patterning my character and was going to do it after the flop broke up, of Snake Plissken, which was Snake Russell, Kurt Russell's character from Escape from L.A. and Escape from New York. And there's only been a couple of guys that actually got away with wearing eye patches and made it look cool. One was Kurt Russell. One was Jeff Bridges. And then John Wayne. And Jeff Bridges and John Wayne basically played True Grit, the same character. But they made eye patches look cool, so I was in pretty good company wearing an eye patch and making it look cool. And I actually had more people tell me that image, that look I had right there, was probably the strongest persona that I had, because it was actually a legit type, you know, image. It was a true persona. Instead of being the corporate babyface good guy, I had a chance to actually be that disgruntled, antisocial person that, you know, in real life, in a sense, I was, because I was tired of being that corporate guy where I had to go out and do tons of autograph sessions as the American Males and tons of this and tons of personal appearances and everything else. Yeah, they were great to do, but we were the only ones doing them because we were the only guys there were. Again, and once I became a bad guy, I was like, I don't want to change. Don't make me be a good guy anymore. And I wanted to keep, and Mr. Godfrey, I don't know if you're still on there or not, I wanted to keep that look, but Terry Taylor, I just never really got along with, just had creative differences, he said, no, I can't do the Snake Plissken image, even though I wanted to do it anyway. He said, no, we want to change you back and make you, you know, lose that image. Keep you as a bad guy. That's fine, but we want to bring back, you know, almost to that narcissist gimmick that Luger did. And that was a Kevin Nash, Terry Taylor idea, because Terry had taken over the booking at eight as the head booker at the time and wanted to take me in a creative difference, because here I am, long-haired, good-looking guy, and wanted to bring that back. Got kind of a nice little push out of it. The mirror thing kind of sucked. I hated it. Actually broke a bunch of them on the road and stuff like that. So I think it's where all my bad luck towards the end there in WCW came from, joking-wise. But, you know, just they were a pain to travel with because I had to bring them with me. So they didn't have, like, WWF or WWE, whatever they call it. They would transport all that stuff. You know, they would keep the belts. I had to carry a WCW World Tag Team title belt around with me. I had a 10-pound belt, and all it did was rip my bag up. You know, it was cool to have. It was great to be a champ, but all it did was tear my bag up and get hooked in my tights and my underwear and my socks and stuff in my bag. And then when you had to go through security, every time I saw it go through security, I saw the belt in there, so you had to open up your bag. Then you're sitting there, you're taking pictures with all these security guys hold on to your belt, and you're like, dude, I got a flight to catch. So, but WWE actually, you know, carried all that stuff for them, so you didn't have to deal with that kind of stuff. WCW, you had to do it on your own. Yeah, you know, a little bit of missed business, but it was still, wrestling was still the WCW thing. So, got a little off the eye patch and the, you know, the Raven thing there, but, you know, still it was, eye patches became a pretty big hit for a while.
Now, when you were in the Flock, you got to have some matches with Chris Benoit. Could you talk about your matches with him and also your relationship with him through the years?
Oh, man, it was a dream working with Chris Benoit. It was, because he was, I mean, the intensity they always talked about with him was real. His chops killed you. I worked him on a 3-day loop one time, having to take Raven's place, and my chest was so swollen after everything, because he just sitting chop all over your chest. He hits the same spot every time with, you know, with violent intentions in a sense, because it was, you know, he came up with the school of, you know, making it credible as possible. And being a shorter guy, but still in great shape and able to do great things, he had to work with that intensity, and that became part of his persona. But basically, behind the scenes, he was the nicest, quietest kind of world. And I loved working with Chris because it was almost like playing football again. You know, because you knew that you were going to get ready to go in there for, you know, a battle that we were going to have. We were both going to enjoy, because I liked that tough competition. I liked that, you know, hit and move and grapple and wrestle and, you know, do some, you know, some movements, some spots and things. But you were going, you know, you're going to come out of there exhausted because, you know, you just gave it your all. And I enjoyed that work on Chris. Some of the guys just didn't want to do that, even on house shows. But Chris did because he loved it. He had a passion for his wrestling. And we were really, really close friends. We got really, really close from our matches and stuff. And I'd actually been to his house numerous times. Him and Nancy. Nancy, she's the sweetest. She could be vicious to the other girls, but she was one, you know, she loved me to death. You know, she used to call Chris, then Chris would go, hang on, and then give me the phone. And I'm like, who's this? Because it's Nancy. She wants to say hello to you. And, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, my relationship with Chris, you know, he treated me like family. He treated me like a friend. We treated each other. We had that much respect for each other. We actually had a legit friendship that we didn't brag about, you know. We didn't travel together a lot. We didn't run in the same circles, but when we had chances to, you know, it was Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, and myself one night in Las Vegas after a Nitro. We were standing in the casino bar area, just kind of cutting up and laughing about the night show, and we look over and I hear Dean Malenko go, "Hook, that guy looks like Ron Jeremy, you know, the porn star." And we're like, "Holy shit, it is Ron Jeremy." And so all of a sudden, Ron Jeremy comes over, and he's a big wrestling fan, so he knows who all of us are. So here I am hanging out with Benoit and Malenko and Guerrero and meeting Ron Jeremy. So, I mean, that's a trip, you know. It was crossover of cultures, but it was still it was one of those things where it was, like, kind of cool, you know, just to meet somebody who else had a, you know, celebrity status to himself. And then that he knew us by name. So, but, you know, Benoit was just was a guy that I highly respected, loved working with, and was really, really a true friend of mine. And then that's how I will always remember him. And because I knew the real Chris, I've gotten into Facebook arguments and other conversations with people or whatever you want to call it, where, you know, people are just, they know the Chris Benoit, the wrestler. They don't know the Chris Benoit, the person. So I'm like, whatever you feel, you don't have, you know, you might think you know something, but until you know the real person, you know, you can't defend, you can't believe or anything. Like, I believe in Chris and will defend Chris and love Chris with my whole heart because I just know who he was. And when the greatest, in a sense, not greatest, but one of the coolest comments I heard Dean Malenko ever say was, you know, Chris and Eddie are dead now, but at least they're back together again because they were really, really true friends. When they were both going through some hard times, they really leaned on each other. And for 2 years after Eddie's death, Chris kept a journal. And we even talked about a few things that he had written in his journal that, you know, and a lot of it were letters to Eddie and just how he missed him and how he loved him. So, you know, it's just it still chokes me up at times to think about things like that. Like I'm getting a little choked up here, but I mean, it's just real life when people don't, you know, that they see your wrestling persona and they think that's the way you are your entire time. And some guys are. You just multiplied, you know, 100 times. You know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, he's rough around the edges. He is a beer drinking, you know. Middle finger flipping type of guy, all the way he's been. But, you know, when you talk to him in person, he laughs, he cuts up with you. He's one of the biggest jokesters there is, and he's a true, genuine guy. But then when you put Stone Cold on him, you know, he's going to be, you know, the rattlesnake that he is. When you have Chris Benoit, the crippler, the toothless aggression, you know, the rabid Wolverine, and that's the only way that people view him in that view, that persona, that intensity. They don't see the quiet, genuine guy that, you know, is really kind of shy around you a little bit until he gets to know you. The last time I saw Chris was about 6 months before the tragic weekend. I went to a show to visit Van Damme and see some of the guys in Jacksonville. I'm standing there, and this guy walks up behind me and grabs my butt. I'm like, "Who in the heck is this?" I spin around, and it's Chris Benoit. And I hadn't spoken to him in about maybe a year, year and a half. We just lost contact. And, you know, that is so out of character for him to walk up behind somebody and grab their butt. You know, that you sat, it caught me by surprise. And he just gave me the biggest hug and said, "Dude, don't you ever disappear from my life again." Gave me his number, his email address, everything else. I was like, "Dude, you know, I know you're living in Hilton Head. Me and Nancy go to Savannah a lot. We love the River Street. Let's definitely keep in touch and hook up and try to meet up down there, you know, sometime along the way and just, you know, reconnect again." He goes, "Because I don't ever want to lose contact with you." So that's how genuine Chris was to me, and that's the Chris, again, that I will always know, love, and defend. People don't know that side of the man, but I do. So don't mind expressing it.
Well, keeping up with that, like the serious note, I guess, right now, it's probably pretty hard because in the wrestling business, there's a lot of death. You've probably lost, you know, dozens of friends over the years. How do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
I'm going to give you almost an honest number of guys that I know personally, that I've had matches with, that I have traveled with, that I have partied with, that I have hung out with, laughed with, you know, shared rooms with, whatever. I've had almost 47 guys that I know personally in the past decade die.
Wow.
Ouch.
So how many people do you, I mean, and that's, and there are other guys that probably have the same numbers, but that's in wrestling. In football, you have a couple here or there, you know, in basketball, a couple here or there from tragedies or accidents or whatever. But for that to happen in one industry, in one sport, in one entertainment business, as Vince likes to call it, you know, where guys are dying either from drug overdoses or heart attacks or whatever, from what they had to do to compete 365 days a year. There's not an off season in wrestling. You know, you traveled, you wrestled every day. You know, you maybe get one or two days off a week, maybe 3 days if you're lucky, or maybe you might get a couple of weeks off if you ask for a vacation. But, you know, we're the only traveling circus, I guess you could say, because we were all a bunch of clowns. But, you know, it was a thing that, it took its toll on you, traveling, mentally, being away from your family, being away from your friends, being away from home, having to pay bills at home and on the road, having to, you know, have people, you know, to watch your house for you, having to make all these travel plans, going overseas. I mean, I've been to Japan 18 times, been to Germany 8 times, England 4 times, you know, all over the U.S., up into Canada. And as things are happening, you find things out. You know, I was there tonight to Brett. We were doing a show in Knoxville, Tennessee, when Owen died at the pay-per-view. I just wrestled Bobby Duncan Jr., of all people, who ended up passing away a few years later, that, you know, we had found out that Owen had died on the pay-per-view. So, you know, and then, you know, to see Brett and see how distraught he was, and, you know, I think it was at Joe Louis Arena when we did our Nitro there. To be in that same building, you know, Brett was just sitting up in the stands by himself. You know, everyone wanted to be with him, but everybody also knew just to give him his peace, you know, just because you had to deal with that. You know, there are times you just got to, you know, have that stiff upper lip, toughen up a bit and realize, hey, things are going to happen. But when you know 47 people by name, by friend that have passed away, by acquaintance, however you want to call it, you know, it definitely messes with you. And then there are guys who, you know, that are still around, who are still battling demons in their life. You know, the Scott Halls is a guy that I know. I've wrestled him a couple times, been around him a bunch, you know, and if I see him, you know, I'm sure we'd be like, hey, Scott, what's up? You know, we'd be cordial and nice to each other. But I know that, you know, the demons that he's been battling. Here's Lex, a guy who was almost paralyzed that I'm still great friends with, and to see the joy in his life now, you know, that he, you know, went from being this Greek god, now he's basically physically a shell of himself, but everything else, he is a rock. So there are, you know, you have your wins and your losses in your life. And you just got to, you know, you just got to be thankful the good Lord above has, you know, a ring, has an arena right now that, you know, are putting on some tremendous shows. He's got some of the best workers in the business up there that are entertaining the other angels through the wrestling matches that he's putting on. He's taking more wrestlers than he has any other athletes, because I guess nobody cares about basketball or football or baseball up in heaven. They got to have too many guys on the team to really perform that, I guess, to the other angels. But, you know, the wrestlers, you're going to have one-on-one, you're going to have tag teams, battle royals and stuff like that. And you can keep the difference, you know. I'm trying to be a little bit of levity here, but, you know, it's still, it's definitely a tough topic to discuss, and the strange thing is it's one of the major topics that I get asked questions about, and I'm not afraid to talk about it because, again, some guys won't talk about Chris Benoit, and they won't talk about what, you know, the things that he went through, and the fact that Vern Gagne is in a old age home, basically killed a man in an old age home, but he's not been demonized.
Nope.
He has basically the same mental, Christian's brain was studied, and Christian Winsky said he has a mind of an 80-year-old with dementia and Alzheimer's. This is a 41-year-old Chris Benoit. Scott Hall killed a guy in, you know, as a 20-something-year-old bouncer in a strip club in Florida, and he's battling the demons personally, but, you know, he's got more sympathy because of his demons than he did. And then nobody, in a sense, because I guess Vern's been out of the scene for so long, he is a 80-something-year-old man, that nobody is going to demonize him for it because, oh, he's old man. But Christopher Maw is a brutal, you know, because of it, because of his rabbit wolverine, you know. You don't know the human being. And then you got two other examples of guys that basically, in a sense, done the same thing, and they're not demonized. You know, that's the cruel contradiction that I think is our society is pathetic about. So that's where I can get really, really vicious with people when they get belligerent with me about it, and I've probably blocked at least a good 50 people off my Facebook because they won't stop. You know, they just keep plugging it. And then even when I get off and tell them to stop, I'm getting off, they would write things on my page and just be cruel, vicious, and inhumane. And they don't even know the guy. They know the wrestling personality. And I'm just like, boom, erase, block, you're done. Because, you know, when you're going to do that, when you're going to attack somebody who can't defend himself, you know, that shows how weak you are. And I don't want anybody who's that weak of a person trying to act like my quote-unquote friend or quote-unquote follower or whatever on Facebook and Twitter, you know. So far Twitter's been cool. I've only been on there a few months, or not a few months, but a few weeks. But, you know, slowly building a little bit of, as people get to know and I'm get to know that I'm on there me and Mick Foley have had some behind-the-scenes things that have been hilarious that I'm like, dude, you know, I stole his own bourbon. So if you have the testicular fortitude to say that last line, because I sent him a text. I can't remember, there was something he came back from his UK tour where he did a comedy thing. And again, here I'm trying to lighten the situation a little bit with some brevity here with Mick. And Mick has taken a complete beating in his life. He's got, you know, he can't even lift one of his legs to put a shoe on or a sock on his foot. And Colette has to do that for him every day because his hip's so bad. But he has said something about the Rock and Sock Connection has over 2.6 million fans, while the American Males, Buff ain't even on Twitter, has, you know, 1,500 plus fans. I've been on there 6 months or 6 weeks. He's been on 20 months, plus he's been on TV and everything else and doing his tours and plugging his deal. And I don't want to have, you know, millions of fans anyway, because how do you respond to them or followers? You can't. You can't have any verbiage. All you can do is throw out tweets and have people load up or overdo your thing that you can't even reply. You know, I mean, how do you beat John Cena with, or The Rock with 1 point something, or who's that, Lady Gaga with 21 million fans or followers on Twitter? There's no way you can actually have any interaction with any of them. I know Goldust is working. I got a, you know, I'm doing a little plug with him for checking him. 2,000 followers by the, or 200,000 followers by the end of the year, and he's at like 170 right now. And I'm just throwing out tweets, and he's retweeting them and thanking me and all this stuff. But But Foley threw a thing out there, and I said, if you have the testicular fortitude, you'll put this, you know, what you just said on real life Twitter and plug me for it. Because back when his son Dewey was like 3-4 years old, and they used to have him and his sister Nicole, who was like a year younger, at the Main Event Fitness, which was Singing Luger's gym, in their nursery, Colette and Mick could work out. And Dewey, I was his favorite wrestler at the time. And Dewey would always want to wrestle, you know, with Mick, and he was Mankind at the time. And Dewey was always, you know, Scotty Riggs, that was his favorite wrestler, because me and him always would cut up and have fun in the daycare for a few minutes. And Scotty Riggs has never, ever lost a match to Mick Foley. And the little tweet I got back, the direct message I got back from Mick today was, yes, I've lost every match to Riggs, and I'm still pissed about it today. And I'm like, dude, if you put that out there, that would be tremendous, just for hilarity's sake, just for fun, just to be the, you know, the comedian that you are, and or that you're becoming. You know, I said that would get probably the biggest pop, you know, than Hulk Hogan's sex tape that's out there. Ugh, I shudder to think that's actually real. But you know, you got to take the good moments like that with Mick and his family, and how I got to know them so well, and Stinger and his family, and everything else. You got to take those moments of joy and talking to Lex, you know, on the phone. It's been probably about a year since we actually spoke, just because, you know, you get busy doing things and you just lose touch with people. Stinger, I talk to him every year, March 20th, because that's his birthday. I always get a call from him and Booker T, March 1st, because me and Booker shared the same birthday, and Stinger will always give me a call and wish me happy birthday. You know, so at least once a year I get in contact with half these cats, you know, and Van Damme, we'll go weeks where we drive each other bananas, talking to each other, texting, talking, tweeting, whatever it is, you know, however, Facebook or whatever it is. And the one time we got in trouble was he was overseas, and we had either called or texted or something, and Sonya, his wife, got the bill, and she ripped both of us new a-holes because the bill was so high. It was all because of Rob, you know, getting the connection fee to call me back over here. It wasn't my side. It was him. But it was all my number. And those are the, you know, you take those moments, you cherish those. Those are the joyful times. So you laugh about them, and you embrace them, you know, and then you got your hard times. You know, when you lose 47 friends in a span of 10 years, you know, when you lose guys that you're so close to, that you used to just see every day, you know, you got to take the good with the bad, and you just got to be, you know, it makes you more, like, you know, like a Bible verse says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. You always just got to somehow sit back and just be a piece of iron out of it sometimes. Even when you're on the inside falling like a baby, you know, you still got to sit back and be strong sometimes for others around you. And you take your turns doing that.
Of course. Well, yeah, that makes sense. That's just, you know, human nature, how to deal with things. It's pretty hard.
Again, the fans, as much as they love the wrestler or superstar, sports entertainer, whatever you want to call them, as much as they love that persona, that character, they don't realize that behind the scenes is a person who's going through marital problems or addictions of some sort, or, you know, just personal issues. You know, your dog died. You know, I remember a friend of mine, his dog died, and he cried for 3 days in a row because his dog. And, you know, those are relationships, you know, animals, you know, and it's, you know, it brings you closer as friends, you know, and it brings you closer as the boys, you know, the wrestlers, you know, whether you work for WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor, independence, whatever, the boys are the boys. We may have our issues, but when it comes to us against management, in a sense, you know, if it's, you know, if you're in any business problem, you stick with the boys. When Raven and Conan and some of those guys walked out when Eric Bischoff told everybody the Nitro, hey, you know, either you like what we're doing or you can go ahead and I'll release you from your contracts right now. First ones up was Raven and Conan because they hated working in there because WCW had become a, you know, you walk on eggshells at a time, and it was not a happy place to work because everything was getting changed because of how the Hall, Nash, Hogan, those guys were trying to use their creative, you know, influence, whatever, and they would come in and change shows. We would be an hour before the show started, and nothing would be on the board of what we're supposed to do, if we were wrestling, what we were doing. You know, you just had to be ready. And it was because of the egos of some of these guys, and I've mentioned most of them because they were mostly the NWO cats. There were all the WWE guys who would come over to WCW. They all came over, and you know, they basically, if people realized it, they were fired by Vince McMahon. Vince Russo, Ed Ferrara came over as supposed major league writers that could save WCW and bring it into, you know, an updated version of what wrestling is supposed to be, were fired by Vince McMahon because they became horrible writers. But they somehow convinced Eric Bischoff and the, you know, Ted Turner, who owned WCW at the time and stuff of that, they convinced them that they were worth $1 million a year contract, all the perks they got with hotels, cars, and rides, and that they should have final input on what TV shows would be like, you know, with the writing of the shows. And it basically killed WCW from being a wrestling company where they tried to turn it into a TV show.
It was horrible.
And that's what turned WCW fans away so hard and so quick. They said, man, this sucks. You know, so that's just, again, how real this stuff is to people that the fans don't know behind the scenes. And I don't care about saying it. Russo and Ferrar killed WCW. Bischoff killed it by giving out these $1 million contracts to guys who were fired by Vince because he thought he could make, you know, they did make an impact for a while. But they were just being selfish by making money for themselves. They weren't worried about the company. They weren't team players. They were coming over because they were fired by Vince. And Eric said, hey, we can take these guys and make them. I'll make this. And as soon as Eric made himself a TV star, he gave himself a contract as a executive vice president and as a performer. So he was getting a dual paycheck. You know, and all he was worried about was making his money because he knew, especially towards the end, that place was a sinking ship, and he was one of the rats that was running off of it. And as soon as I saw him and Hogan take over and do stuff in TNA, I started sitting back going, man, that place is just going to get unhappy. And they've had issues there where a lot of the workers have been unhappy with how Bischoff and those guys are trying to run the show because they're trying to do the same thing they did in WCW. Make themselves the focal point. They're not. You know?
Especially with their age and stuff. But real fast, Scotty, we actually have a request. We have, like, very limited amount of time left on the show. We would like to see, because we still have, like, a lot to ask. Is there any way we could get you back on in a couple of weeks and finish this up? Oh, great.
I'll call back next week if you want to.
I don't believe we're having a show next week, but the week after, we would like to have you back on.
I'm just saying, whenever you want me to come back, I'll definitely come back, and we can pick up where we left off, because, like I'm sure you have a lot more questions to ask, but I have a lot more answers to give, too, because you won't find guys, you know, you'll get maybe other guys on the show who will do stuff, but they won't be as open as I am because they still want to keep, you know, promoters happy or keep themselves right with fans' eyes. You know, all I'm worried about is, hey, I had a great career. I enjoyed it. I made the most of it. I got my fans, and I'm not bitter about anything. People can go, oh, he's just this. I'm like, no. I just, the fans want to hear the realism of what goes on. They don't want a wrestling promo. They don't want a gaga that they can see on Monday nights or Thursday nights or pay-per-views or whatever. They want the real thing. And I don't mind giving them the real thing because I lived it. I breathed it for, you know, 17 plus years. So, and did it through sleeping from in my car to, you know, owning a house and, you know, getting a six-figure paycheck, you know, and just things that, you know, I went from the, you know, the poorhouse to the penthouse to the outhouse, you know. It's been a ride up and down all over the thing. So, and I don't mind saying it. You know, some guys do. Some guys are afraid to. I'm not. So I don't mind ever coming back.
We really, really appreciate you calling in and taking all these questions. We will catch back up with you in 2 weeks. Everybody, we're going to have Scotty back on in 2 weeks. And thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. And I will catch back up with you this week, and we'll work all the details out. So thanks again.
Hey, that was very good. You got my digits and everything, so please holler. And for all the fans out there who are still listening, if you haven't fallen asleep yet, just, you know, keep up with me either on Facebook or if you want to do some live one-on-one kind of commentary, catch me on my Twitter, @RealScottyRig. So, you know, just I enjoyed chatting with you guys. And, yeah, in 2 weeks I'll be happy to get back on here, and we'll have part two and have some more fun.
Part two with Scotty Riggs coming in 2 weeks. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yes, all right, my friend. Thank you.
All right, Cotrere. We have very limited time left on the show, and we're going to be doing a WrestleMania show next week. It's not going to be a normal show. We're just going to do the WrestleMania coverage show next week. And then the week after, we're going to have Scotty Riggs back. So just real fast before we go, let's run down the WrestleMania card. And
I got the card in front of me if you don't.
No, I do not. So you go ahead and list them, and then we'll each give a little opinion on the match, and then we'll shut this thing up. So do it.
Okay. Start at the bottom. We have Beth Phoenix and Eve Torres against Kelly Kelly and Maria Menounos.
Yeah,
I like Maria Menounos. She's been very good at the time she's wrestled.
Yeah, she hasn't been bad. I mean, it's a nothing match. It's like it might get add interest to the pay per view, but I mean, it's going to be nothing big. It's just one of those things. So I mean, yeah,
they can have a segment on Extra or something like that to, you know, like, show highlights of it or something like that. So I don't really care who wins or loses, so it don't matter to me.
Yes.
We have Team Teddy, which at this point is Santino Marella as the captain, R-Truth, Kofi Kingston, Zack Ryder, The Great Khali, and somebody else to be announced, and Hornswoggle as the mascot, I guess, against Team Johnny, with David Otunga as the captain, with Mark Henry, Christian, Dolph Ziggler, Jack Swagger, and another guy to be announced. And, yeah, I just read on the, like you were talking earlier, that it looks like Miz and Mick Foley may be sliding into the spots. You know, Mick Foley on Team Teddy and Miz on Team Johnny.
That match could be fun. I'm sure it's not going to be very long. But, I mean, it could be fun, and I like all the dudes being out there. And, you know, it's just a spot to get all the guys on the show. And another thing, it should just be pretty fun. Like, you know, like it's going to be a fun match. I like storyline-oriented matches. You know, it doesn't have to be a work rate, amazing, you know, match. This isn't War Games. This isn't anything. It's just a fun little match. And, like, I'm happy it's part of the show. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm hoping Team Johnny wins so he gets to be the GM on both shows, because I just like his character so much, even though a lot of people don't.
Oh, I think he's great as well. All right, what do we got next?
We got Randy Orton versus Kane. I'm going to go with Randy Orton here. I actually would have preferred Randy Orton against Daniel Bryan instead of Sheamus, because I thought it would be a better match. But I think Randy Orton deserves a little better than Kane at WrestleMania.
Everybody deserves more than Kane. Kane is like Kane is the black eye of the WWE. It's just he's horrible. He's never been good. I've never liked Kane, really, and you know, I could care
less. I liked
him
when he did the first feud with The Undertaker. That's about it.
That's it. All right, what do we got next?
Cody Rhodes against The Big Show.
We both know who I'm rooting for, so who are you rooting for?
I'm not really so much rooting for him. I'd like to see Cody Rhodes win because he's gotten a good push like the last year or so. And but I think just with the storyline of Big Show being embarrassed, I think he's going to embarrass Cody and win the match.
The only thing that I'm disappointed in is that I wanted it to be Cody and Goldust at WrestleMania. I really wanted that. And the thing is about that, like, Big Show could have been on Team Teddy or something like that, and they could have found a spot for him. It's just, you know, it is what it is. It's one of those throwing together
things. Although the videos every week embarrassing Big Show have entertained the shit out of me.
Yes, yes, it's been fantastic. All right, what do we have after that?
Daniel Bryan defending the world title against Sheamus. I'd keep it on Daniel Bryan because I think he's got a good act as a heel going.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. And Sheamus is just there right now. He's not really, you know, he's not really doing all that much. He's just there.
Yeah, so, all right, next we have CM Punk defending the WWE title against Chris Jericho.
I've said this before. I'm just not into it. I don't know. I'm just not into it.
I've gotten into stuff the last couple of weeks with the alcoholic father and crackhead sister or something like that. Kind of push it a little bit more.
Yes. Yes. I'm not a big Chris Jericho fan. Like
I'm a big Jericho fan, but I think Punk's a little overrated to me.
I actually am a big Punk fan, but I kind of think Jericho's overrated. So, I mean,
he needs to stop doing that elbow. That's the insult to Randy Savage.
Well, if it was Lance Storm booking all of this, as we hear every week, you know, Chris Jericho would be the champion of the world always. And,
well, you know, they're coming to Chicago next month for Extreme Rules, so I could see Punk losing and winning it back next month.
Yes, yes, that is very much.
Are you going to that show next month?
I actually am. Yes, I will be there.
Okay, cool.
I will be there live.
Next, we have Triple H versus The Undertaker with Shawn Michaels as the referee in the Hell in the Cell. I'm thinking Taker's going to win, but this match, I really don't know what's going to happen. You know, the last 3 years of Taker matches, I've been on the edge of my seat during all the near falls and stuff, thinking he might lose.
I don't have a clue. I really, really don't have a clue.
And that's a good thing.
Like, you hear those rumors about Lesnar coming in to wrestle Undertaker, or even Lesnar against The Rock now that there's rumors. So you never know. You never know what's going to happen. It's just, we got to wait and see. That's by far what I'm most excited about is that match, of course.
Yeah, I think it's going to steal the show like it did last year. So,
of course.
I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, that's all a great part of watching it. It was going to happen. Then you have The Rock against John Cena. Again, I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm just going to, you know, watch and see. Not really anything I want to happen. I'm just looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great spectacle.
Yes, we're going to sit back and enjoy it. The next week's show is going to be late at night, I'm sure. It's going to be very, very late at night. We'll work that out and figure out, like, how we're going to do it and stuff and how we're going to work
that
out.
The show starts at 6. And it's 4 hours, so I'm sure we'll need like an hour, like whatever time after that before we can get together. So
I'll figure it out because I'm actually having a party over here, a WrestleMania party, having a bunch of people
over. Yeah, I'm
going
to a party myself. So
it's got to be fantastic. So everybody, be sure to tune in next week. Pay attention to the board, pay attention to Facebook, and we'll get the times there for you when that show is going to be. So thank you again to Scotty Riggs. A great guest, but really, really informative. Man,
we didn't have to say much.
Yeah, we did not have to say much at all because he was spilling his guts, and that's the kind of stuff we like. So
I was able to take a break and smoke me a cigarette a couple of times there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he was very good guest. We really appreciate him calling in. And we'll be back with him in a couple of weeks. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with a WrestleMania review. And thanks, everybody, again, for listening. And it's been a really great time. Thanks, Couture.
Thank you.